everyone, and welcome back to another fun episode of Chop On. If you're joining us for the very first time, thank you so much for joining us, and we hope that you enjoy the show. We appear every Wednesday in the USA at 8:30 p.m. EST, Thursday morning in India and Australia at 6 a.m. IST and 10 a.m. ACST. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ChopOnPod. We have our link tree attached to those pages to find the right podcast platform to listen to. Once you find that platform, please like, rate, review, and most importantly, make sure you subscribe to your favorite podcast that blends together cricket with wrestling. My name is Rajiv, and I am here with the one, the only, Bharat Sundaresan. Hello, brother. How are you doing this week?
Oh, I'm doing great, Rajiv. I love to see your face. I love to hear your voice. And, speaking of the one and only Bharat Sundaresan, I did something yesterday which I never thought I would, which is I tried to get myself verified on Twitter. I don't even know why I did that. Like, I've never given it too much important, but I was googling something and it just popped up that Twitter has restarted that. And a lot of people have told me, why don't you have a blue tick? Why don't you have a blue tick? Like, why would anyone else want to be Bharat Sundaresan?
You deserve a blue tick. I mean, who else is in the cricket game that does such great things that you do? Let's be honest. You are, as I've said before on this show, the premier cricket journalist. You need the blue tick.
Well, there you go. Well, I don't know whether I am the premier voice in cricket. I am becoming very rapidly the most annoying voice in cricket because I do talk a lot. But I don't know. Let's see if they give me the blue tick and if it changes my life in any way. But you know what, Rajiv? The best part about the last few days for me, and this is a cheap plug for what I think is a fun podcast, was listening to Talking Dreams, the latest episode, where not only did I get to question you or pose questions to you via Alex and found out that you only tried cooking Indian food once, and also that Alex doesn't really like me. We'll talk about that later. I've sent you SMSs, heartbroken SMSs to you. So, Alex, if you are listening to this, I am despondent. Firstly, you say that, he's your friend. I don't know him. Well, okay, that was strike one. Strike two, of course, was you refusing to even take my name, just saying, referring to me as your podcast host. Well, we'll wait for strike three. So there hasn't been a strike three yet. Hopefully there isn't. But even if there is, you won't be out, Alex. You know how much I love you and Rajiv as a pair, as a couple, as a team. But it was wonderful listening to your answers. We all know about your questions, Rajiv. For once, you were the man with the answers. But I got to know a lot more about you. And I think I like you more. I respect you more.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. If anybody is even remotely interested, Talking Dreams comes out on Fridays usually when I have a guest. This last week I didn't have a guest, so I thought I would turn the tables and have people ask me the questions. So it was a lot of fun to do, and I tried to be as open and honest as possible with my answers, and I think I did an okay job. And hey, if you like and respect me more, then I must have done my job.
Yeah, you were exceptional.
Thank you. And if you have never listened to our podcast right here, Chop On, before, we are going to take topics related to cricket and wrestling and discuss them for 5 minutes maximum each. If we end a topic before the 5 minute mark, then great. Otherwise, we are going to cut ourselves off at the 5 minute mark. And we know that we have listeners that love cricket but don't know wrestling, or they love wrestling and maybe don't know cricket. So we try to enlighten our listeners as if we're Eric Bischoff from 83 Weeks by having a term or rule of the week, and also a history lesson. And I also have a new microphone here, brother. How am I sounding? Am I sounding good?
Yes, you seem to have an added element of bass to your voice, which is never a bad thing. So
no, yeah, I will take great. It. I will take it. Now, are you ready to do this, brother?
Let's rotate the strike.
All right, we are going to rotate the strike. I will present topics and we will go back and forth discussing these. The very first topic, New Zealand and England's first touch. I did this earlier too. New Zealand and England's first test match, easy for me to say, came to a draw last week. New Zealand were 378 all out in their first innings. England were 275 all out. New Zealand in their second innings were 169 for six before weather played spoil sport there, and they declared during the break. Then England would go 170 for three in their second innings before the match came to a close on day five. Brother, what is one positive and one negative that came out of this test match? And for this one, I think we're going to stay with what happened on the field and go.
Yes. Yes, let's please stay on the field because there's so much off-field drama that we need to talk about and which we will as the show goes on. For me, I thought it was a classic old-school test match. A lot of people were enraged by England's approach in their second innings. They thought they should have at least shown a little more intent. There you go, that word again, intent in cricket. And looked like they were going for the target. And maybe if they lost a few wickets, then shut shop. But I am of the strong belief that with that brittle batting lineup, England had no option. You know, they were 120 out for six in the first innings, if not for Ollie Robinson on debut, you know, showing a lot of character with the bat. And Rory Burns being slightly fortunate, but also very, very gritty. They would have been facing a follow-on. And again, you also have to keep in mind that we lost an entire day's play to rain. That did not help matters. And it wasn't an easy pitch either. It wasn't a pitch where you could just score fluently. You could survive. But it was up and down. The ball was seaming around. And I thought New Zealand bowled exceptionally well in their second innings. The likes of Jameson and Neil Wagner, Wagner, came into their own. They found their rhythm. And for me, that was the biggest positive from that test match from a very cricketing sense. Because leading into that World Test Championship final, which is coming up very soon, I want both teams, both the Indian and the New Zealand teams, to be firing. Like, you know, it's a final. It's a World Test Championship final, the first ever. So you want both teams to have 11 fit players. We want them to have their best 11s out there. And also everyone in good rhythm and in good form. So Neil Wagner and Kyle Jameson took their time to get used to Lords. Jameson was playing his first test at Lords. But I thought they really came into their own in the second innings. And it bodes well for us neutral fans. Like, you're more an India fan than I am. But, you know, it should make for a good World Test Championship final. The negative for me was really England's batting. Not in terms of them not going for the target, but just the way in some of their younger batsmen threw their wickets away. Zach Crawley, for one, we've heard so many good things about him from R. Ashwin and anyone who's watched him bat. Even I think the 20 odd minutes he batted in the day-night test, he just was looking brilliant when he was striking those boundaries. And he did get that massive 267 against Pakistan last year at home. But him getting out to a very loose shot in the first innings, maybe you could pardon it, but him getting out in the second innings to a very similar shot to Tim Southee's bowling made you raise eyebrows. Dan Lawrence also played a loose shot. And these are kind of shots, Rajiv, you expect opposition teams or opposition batsmen to come and play in their first test on English soil, not seasoned county players. And these guys might be young, but they played all their cricket in England. So that was very disappointing, the fact that it looked like some of them are taking their places for granted. Because at some point, the likes of Stokes and Butler and maybe even Johnny Bairstow will come back. So, yeah, you are just risking your own immediate future by playing that way.
Yeah, I'll say that for me, the biggest positive was having Test cricket back. For some reason, it felt like it had been a very, very long time in between Test matches. I don't know why it felt that way, but maybe it's the access I have here in America. Maybe I've been missing some Test matches. I don't know, but it just felt good to have Test cricket. And when you see numbers like Ollie Robinson, he was 4 for 75 and then 3 for 26. And then you have Tim Southee, 6 for 43 and 1 for 37 with a very short second innings for England. Devin Conway, 200 off 347. Rory Burns, 132 off 297. Obviously, neither of them were so lucky the second time around, but still, they did great. The biggest negative for me was losing day three. I mean, I think we would have had a result had there been a day three. At least it was playing that way. New Zealand they had a really good momentum going their way, and they definitely would have declared no matter what, because you know they had set such a high bar there, especially with how, like you said, England's batting wasn't doing so great. And I, you know, interesting to me that that would happen because county cricket's been going on over there. But yeah, biggest positive, test cricket being back, and biggest negative is having day three just get completely washed out like that. If we even had a little bit of cricket on day three, I think a result would have come out of it.
Absolutely. And just having crowds back at Lord's was just special. I mean, oh, that fantastic. Guy coming with a raincoat was great TV.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. All right, moving on. WWE has once again released an array of talent, and this time top stars were not even spared. The list of released superstars included Ruby Riott, Aleister Black, Santana Garrett, Buddy Murphy, Lana, and Braun Strowman. The question here is, which release surprised you the most? And do you think this has to do with the rumor of Vince McMahon looking to sell WWE? I think for me, the biggest surprise, well, there were two big surprises for me. It was Braun Strowman on the men's side and then Lana on the women's side. But then again, for Lana, with Miro being gone and with AEW, maybe not so big of a surprise, but it seemed like they were giving her a pretty big push, especially working in a tag team at the time. So it just seemed to me like they had big plans for her, and then they just suddenly let her go. And then same with Braun Strowman. He was just in a triple threat match for the world title at WrestleMania Backlash. And I know that they had signed him to a really, really big deal around the time AEW was starting to sign a bunch of people and Braun Strowman's contract was coming up. So it just really surprises me that somebody of his stature and his place on the card got let go. And as far as this rumor of Vince McMahon looking to sell WWE, Eric Bischoff said on 83 Weeks that if you look around Vince McMahon's office, you can see how much family plays into his life. And if you ask me, that to me says it all. Vince McMahon Sr. had the company before Vince McMahon Jr. did. And I think Vince wants his family to take it over, and he wants to carry on the McMahon name as long as possible. Whether it's Stephanie or Shane, it doesn't really look like it's going to be Shane at any point, but I think he wants to keep it in the family. The only way I see him selling is if it's written into the terms that a McMahon has to work for this company at all cost until it is just outright revoked from a McMahon in the future. Otherwise, I think he keeps WWE as long as he can.
Tough to disagree with you. And I have been completely in agreement with Eric Bischoff. The fact that it looks more like they're preparing to buy something rather than to sell something. But Conrad Thompson seems very convinced that they are going to sell. And he's basing this purely on his own logic. I don't think he's using any insider information to say that. But firstly, in terms of who I was surprised by in terms of releases, I thought Aleister Black, considering they spent so much money in like bringing him back to life in a way with this, what I would look felt like a slightly new character. There were some similarities to his old gimmick, but you know, every week there was a vignette of him talking about something. He just then moved past that vignette stage and, he was in the ring. He attacked Big E. I don't know. I thought like it was rarely that WWE build up someone like that and then just go poof. Braun Strowman, now that you listen to their reasons in hindsight for these people being cut off the roster, if they're saying we wanted to save some money, then maybe Braun Strowman makes sense because he was in comparison by far the most highly paid, the highest paid amongst those who have been released. So that does make sense from a very financial or logical point. Apart from Aleister Black, I mean, I wasn't too surprised with Lana. We've seen even with John Moxley and his wife, once someone moves out, one partner moves out, it's been rare to, I mean, of course, we will not see Charlotte Flair going to AEW anytime soon, even though Andrade has made his debut there. But I wasn't surprised by that. But from all, someone like Ruby Riott, even though she hasn't been used as a top star, just reading about her and listening to what people say about her, she seems to have been the X-Pac of this era, where you know every time you want to push a new female star, even though she herself is not too old, They use her as a yardstick of sorts. So I was surprised by that. The others, well, yeah, I mean, I was shocked when Samoa Joe was let go. So Buddy Murphy and those, as talented as they are, yeah, maybe you shouldn't be surprised by anyone being left off. As far as WWE selling it, I was convinced that they're not. But then I saw the finish of last night's Raw, and I was like, it almost finished like a cliffhanger in a Netflix TV show of sorts, right? Like where the lights go out and there's a woman screaming, Shayna Baszler in this case, and there's a doll in the mirror. Then it got me thinking. Conrad keeps talking about Disney and WWE. Could WWE just become more of a cinematic experience? I was reading quotes from Nick Khan, who says this is not sports entertainment, or this is not wrestling. It's sports entertainment. You don't even use the word wrestling. So pro wrestling. So I don't know if that is the case. If we are going to see more cinematic finishes to Raw or to a SmackDown. Maybe, just maybe they go out there. But I keep thinking about what will Triple H do then, right? Like, you know, he is such a wrestling nuff. His life has been wrestling, not just in the ring or outside the ring as well. And he's built up this NXT brand. So more than Vince McMahon, when I look at Triple H, I just think, yeah, maybe they're not selling. I just don't know. I can't picture him doing anything else. And I'm not putting it past anyone for WWE and AEW to merge. Someday. Yeah, who knows? But not anytime soon.
WWE has announced that SummerSlam will indeed be held on Saturday, August 21st in Las Vegas at the Allegiant Stadium. This puts SummerSlam on the exact same night and time as Manny Pacquiao and versus Earl Spence Jr., which is being held in Las Vegas as well at the MGM Grand. On the Wrestling Observer radio show, Dave Meltzer noted that he was told SummerSlam might not be a long show. The plan is to have the show finish just in time for the boxing main event so that fans can walk over and watch that fight. With both shows starting at the same time, the Pacquiao-Spence Jr. fight could start at 11 p.m. Eastern time. As to why the show is on a Saturday instead of the normal Sunday slot, Meltzer said that Allegiant Stadium always wanted a show on Saturday and did not initially know the boxing fight would be on the same night. WWE is in hopes of a WrestleMania-like gate for SummerSlam, which is why Vegas and a stadium were chosen for the show. Firstly, is it smart to hold SummerSlam in a huge football stadium, and is it smart to have it on the exact same night and the exact same time as a boxing match?
I think we touched on this a couple of weeks back when I think WWE first started talking about maybe taking SummerSlam to Vegas. And, you know, it got me firstly thinking about how I always wanted to go to Las Vegas. And, you know, someday my co-host and me, Rahiv and I, will hit the streets of Vegas. And considering we are two dull, boring guys, Rajiv, whatever happens in Vegas, we will be told to a lot of people around the world.
Lots.
I don't see us indulging in any sort of debauchery, but, you know, just a lot of good fun. Again, this is WWE just backing themselves with the fan base they have and the confidence they have in their product to go head-to-head with a massive boxing fight, which, of course, is generally the most sought-after pay-per-view event if we've seen in the last few years. I remember the Manny Pacquiao fight. Who was it against? Was it Floyd Mayweather when those two? Yeah,
Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather did a huge buy on pay-per-view.
Oh, that was incredible. Even I'm not a big boxing fan, but I remember watching it in India when that became, when that happened. So it's a big challenge, but what it tells me is we're going to expect some big names for SummerSlam. So there's already talk of John Cena, maybe Brock Lesnar. We'll talk about it later. Maybe The Rock, who knows? They are heading in that direction. If they are so confident, like with going head to head with a massive boxing fight, so A, they better have enough in their arsenal to pull it off, and Or B, maybe they already do. Maybe they are going to bring back a lot of stars. Will you prefer watching John Cena or Manny Pacquiao? I don't know. And, you know, and a boxing fight versus a wrestling pay-per-view, which has a lot of, I mean, it's the second biggest pay-per-view in the WWE calendar. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work out. But I back the WWE's judgment on matters of money. Maybe not with their creative and what the show they put on. But when it comes to money, I think nobody knows better than Vince McMahon how to make money with wrestling. So there is definitely a plan he has in place.
So I'll agree with your statement of in wrestling, nobody knows how to make money better than Vince McMahon. But where I disagree with you is backing WWE on this decision. So SummerSlam, Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, Survivor Series, those four pay-per-views have the biggest name of any wrestling pay-per-view ever of all time. And I think WWE is trying to bank on that, but here's the problem with that. If a fan is not invested in your product and only watches the big four pay-per-views, but there's a bigger event going on at the exact same time, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to go for the other event that's a bigger name. And on top of that, they've been in Vegas before in their small arena. I mean, small, 15,000 people, and they couldn't even sell it out. They were doing a buy one, get one free promotion because they couldn't sell their tickets. So I think they're going to have a very hard time getting people in there, even with the caveat that, hey, you're still going to make it in time for the main event. I just don't see a lot of people buying into that. I hope I'm wrong. I want wrestling to succeed as a whole because I'm such a big fan of it. But it just, to me, it just seems like there's an ego here. Not necessarily that this is the right financial decision for our company to make. This is the ego of we are WWE. We're in a stadium. Why wouldn't people want to come even if there's a boxing match here? So again, I agree. Vince McMahon is probably the smartest money man in wrestling that's not named Conrad Thompson. But as far as trying to get people into the building for SummerSlam, I don't see it. I really don't.
As more of a wrestling fan than a boxing fan, I do hope you're wrong and I do hope I'm right.
And now we are going to move on to probably our hardest topic today. Ollie Robinson will miss the second test against New Zealand at Edgbaston after being suspended from international cricket by the ECB, pending an investigation into the racist and sexist tweets that he had posted as an 18-year-old. The tweets were discovered on Wednesday, June 2nd, the first day of Robinson's test debut at Lord's, and made public while he was taking four wickets in New Zealand's first innings. As good as Robinson was in his debut test match, his performance has been totally overshadowed by the nature of these tweets. Before play on Wednesday, the England players, Robinson included, had stood in front of the Lord's Pavilion during a moment of unity, wearing t-shirts with slogans that read, "We stand together against racism," and "We stand together against sexism," amongst others. Robinson has apologized for the tweets and said he was going through a difficult time period in his life when he sent out the offensive tweets. While Robinson will not be able to play international cricket, he could still play for Sussex during this investigation. But like I said at the beginning of this is a tough one. But what do you see as the best course of action here?
It is a tough one. I was very, very convinced with where I stood with this matter 2 days ago, Rajiv, when I last did a show with Mel. Where I felt like, yeah, I mean, he should be suspended for one test match. I mean, you have to kind of see the verbiage used here as well. I mean, he has not been punished yet. They've just suspended him so that they can conduct an inquiry and investigation into the matter and see where he was, what he said, was he contracted. There have been arguments that he was still an adult. If he can vote, he should be held accountable for what he says. There's no surprise that he's not playing the next test match in Birmingham. And like I said, he's not been punished yet. They've just said, you know, you need to step out. And every time there's an inquiry or an investigation anywhere in any facet of life or in any company or any institution, you are asked to step back or step out for a while till the inquiry is finished. So people have jumped the gun, including British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has come out and said, no, it's too harsh a judgment by the ECB. So it's very difficult to 100% say that, no, this is right or that is wrong. Look, what he did tweet, racism and any kind of ism should be snubbed out. I mean, should be cut out completely. It'll take a long time. Society is changing. Already things that you were okay with being said a few years ago, we can't say anymore. I mean, I'll give you an example. Like when my wife became a special needs teacher many years ago. It was okay even then, maybe 10, 12 years ago, to say kids with mental retardation, which was the technical term, the medical term. But you can't say that anymore. So in that way, so does that make people who said it then, was it an offense in some ways? I don't know. Like, you know, the society is changing. People are changing. People should be given a second chance. I do stick with guys like Nasser Hussain and Michael Atherton, who've spoken about how exclusion doesn't help, education does. I'm all for it. But this should become a deterrent to people, right? This should become a deterrent so that nobody else goes ahead and just says things that, look, I have the freedom of speech. I have a platform because of what I do on the sporting field. So I should just be allowed to say whatever I want. So while that should be snubbed out, what has happened though is something I didn't expect, because I am slightly technologically challenged. I still don't know how to go and look for tweets from the past. I've tried to look for some tweets of my own, but like from 2012 or 13, I haven't found them. So now, as you know, people have gone back and from everyone, from Jimmy Anderson to Owen Morgan to Joss Butler, they pulled out allegedly racist or sexist tweets. The Jimmy Anderson, of course, had deleted a tweet where he had said tweeted, something along the lines of the haircut Stuart Broad was had at that point made him look like a 15-year-old lesbian. He's of course deleted that tweet, but of course nothing goes away on the internet, right? Someone had taken a screenshot, so that's come to the picture. So now it's just opened this the proverbial Pandora's box where you don't know where it's going to end. So I'm confused. I don't know whether it's right. How far back do you go? Like, you know, should people have an amnesty if they have changed, if they have changed their opinions? I guess it's gone from one person needing education to, I guess, all of us needing education on this matter. And definitely, this should be a deterrent for anyone who thinks it's okay to go out and say whatever they want to, not just in person, but on social media. But at the same time, like I said, there should also be a license to people for them to be able to change.
I'll be honest with our listeners here. I almost left this topic off because of the tough nature of it, but I would have felt like we were cheating our audience, because if people are of the cricket world that are listening to us, they would wonder why it wasn't even brought up, because it's such a big happening right now. But I'm with you on the fact that people change over time. There are many, many things that in my youth I have said that I wish I could go back and not say, because it was okay. It was socially acceptable to say certain things like you were talking about. It was socially acceptable if someone did something dumb to say, hey, you're retarded. I would never say that today, because that's just not right. Being a young kid, you make these silly mistakes like this. I think that's what it is. It's a silly mistake that perhaps 10 years later, because he's almost 28 now, so it's been about 10 years since these tweets have happened, perhaps he wouldn't even say these things today. So I do think it is right that they suspended him for the next test match, so that way they can do a further investigation into this matter. I think he should be given a second chance, though. He seemed very genuine in his statement, and you could even see when he was on the field, he was rattled because of all this that had come out. The Ollie Robinson that started day one was not the same Ollie Robinson that finished the match. So he's definitely going through it, and I feel for him on that. Is what he said right? No, absolutely not. He acknowledged that. So I feel like as long as someone acknowledges their wrongdoing and is at least willing to maybe take a sensitivity course or something along that line of trying to better themselves and be a better person, then we should give them a second chance. Now, if tomorrow he comes out with a tweet that's similar in nature, then absolutely kick him out of cricket altogether. I don't want to see him, but I feel like we need to give him a second chance.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I've always believed everybody deserves second chances. People make mistakes, and we all have, like you said, like, you know, I've said things, you have said things, everybody said things and done things that you regret, like, you know, or when you're young, you do, which you regret later on. And yeah, you're right. I mean, from whatever he said, there seems to be regret. But the one thing we haven't spoken about it is it could just get much, much more controversial because right. The replacement for Ollie Robinson at this point is Craig Overton. And he has had his issues as well. Unlike Ollie Robinson, who tweeted stuff in 2015 on the field, Craig Overton told a English cricketer of Pakistani origin, you know, you effing go back to where you came from. And he was suspended just for 2 games. He has given interviews recently talking about how he didn't say it, and he is a changed person. So it's just going to get even more complex and complicated for the English and England and Wales cricket board and the team. I mean, it did take away from what I thought was a wonderful debut on the field for Ollie Robinson. But I'm with you, Rajiv. I think it's led to a wider discussion where, you know, about not just about society, but social media as well. And I think we all eventually will end up learning a lot from it.
Let's all just strive to be better. I know we can all do better, us included. And now we're going to move on to something much more lighthearted. We are moving on to our next segment, Fact or Fiction. I will present a topic, and then we will each say whether we think it is fact or fiction, and then make arguments as to why that is. Our first one, we were just talking about SummerSlam, so let's do it again. It was reported that WWE officials would like Brock Lesnar to come back for WWE SummerSlam. Our first statement for fact or fiction is, if Brock Lesnar came back for SummerSlam, the gate would increase significantly.
I think it is fact, because Brock Lesnar does turn the dial. Wherever he goes, every time he's made a comeback to the WWE or on screen anyway, things have picked up. You know, he's just that kind of character. He's that kind of gimmick. He is just Brock Lesnar, right? He is this sense of realism about him. Which at many levels right now in the WWE does not exist. So he will immediately add a lot to the product. And it looks like from whatever we are hearing or whatever we read, initially it was thought as Brock Lesnar versus Roman Reigns whenever he comes back. We've seen enough of that. So thankfully it looks like, and it'll be heel versus heel and Paul Heyman in the middle. It seems like a very predictable outcome. I don't think the world needs a face Roman Reigns ever again. But it looks like it could be Brock Lesnar versus Bobby Lashley. And it's something that a lot of people have looked forward to for a long time. Both have took a break from the WWE and, like, you know, tried their hand out in UFC and other MMA competitions. So I think that will be a very physical battle. And I mean, we don't get to see those kind of physical, outcomes in the ring anymore. So it'll be great, great TV whenever those two go head to head. Maybe that is what will take the viewers away from boxing and bring them back to wrestling. Who knows? And I think Bobby Lashley has been the one positive out of Raw, really, him being champion. For a long time, he was positioned as a comedy act with Rusev and Lana and all that. It was kind of icky. But now it looks like they finally found his niche for him. So yeah, Brock Lesnar will turn the dial and he'll make it happen.
I agree that I would absolutely love to see Brock Lesnar versus Bobby Lashley, but this statement is complete fiction. And here's why. You had already said yourself that Bobby Lashley and Brock Lesnar come also from the MMA world, not just the wrestling world. And what is one thing about MMA that people love? The unpredictability of a quote unquote real fight. I think that aspect of it is going to draw the MMA fans to the boxing match, not to wrestling on the Peacock network. I do think that having Brock Lesnar on is going to draw interest for sure. And I do think that more people will watch it on Peacock as opposed to that wouldn't if he wasn't on. But I don't think it's going to be so significant that less people are going to buy the boxing match. That is absolutely not true. And that is why I say this statement is pure fiction.
Okay, what if there is a WWE run-in at the boxing match? What if we see a repeat of DX invading WCW happen with...
You know, I would not put it past WWE to do something like that. I wouldn't even put it past, because they're both in Vegas at the same time, having something happen on both pay-per-views. So that way it can draw the wrestling audience like, hey, this boxing is going on over here. And the boxing fans like, hey, if you have Peacock... It's only $5 to get it, so here you go. So I would, that statement, brother, is fact. I think that could happen.
You heard it here first.
Our next statement, because it is a championship match, there should be a winner for the World Test Championship. Is that fact or fiction? I think it is a fact. So I'm not opposed to the idea of if there's a draw, you have two winners. But when it's a championship, you want an outcome. You want a winner. I mean, how would we feel if in the World Cup, if we had the West Indies and India and the match ended in a draw? Would we be happy that they're both holding up the trophy? I don't think so. What about the T20 World Cup? If Australia was against England and they both won, would we be happy that they were both holding up the cup? No, we would not be happy at all. So I think because it's a championship makes it different than a regular test match. If this means drawing it out for an extra day to have an actual winner, then hey, I say we do it. So that way we have a winner. Obviously, that's not the way they're going. They're going to go with, if there's a draw, then they're both champions. But I think even for a casual viewer, especially, that you need a winner when it's a championship match. You don't want two people sharing a trophy. That would be like in the Olympics too. If two people won, oh, you're both gold medalists. No, you're representing your country and you want to bring the trophy back to your country. You don't want to share it with another, especially if it's a championship.
You know, Rajiv, all my life, I always thought that I am the realist and everyone I speak to is the romantic. But for a change, I think I am the romantic in this case. And I think it is fiction, because when there is a draw, the old cliche goes, cricket's the winner. And, you know, it's a term that gets used a lot in press boxes around the world, where you think eventually when you have nothing to write about, you just say cricket's the winner, or you say cricket's the winner when you have nothing to say on commentary. But I think the draw is the only unique aspect of test cricket, which makes it more special than any other form of sport in my book. I mean, there are draws in soccer, there are draws in all other sport, but the way you can play for a draw, I mean, in the way you defend to play for a draw, the way you do it in cricket, I think is very unique. I just take you back to Sydney like 4 or 5 months ago when Ashwin and Hanuma Vihari batted the way they did. And save the test match. They put their bodies and careers on the line, not to win, but to just save that test match for a draw, playing for a draw. It's an art form in its own. And like it is, like I said, it's part of test cricket. It's one of the unique facets of test cricket. So it should be rewarded. So if New Zealand or India are in a position where they can't win, but they have to grind it out, hard, tough, cheka, as Ravi Shastri would say, if we have to play hard cricket for 1.5 days and... save the day and win the championship for your country, I think it's great, because you'll always hear that term being used in cricket, test cricket, right? All three results are possible. Technically, all four, because the tie is always a possibility, but we've had only two tie tests in the history of the game. But, you know, that could be a history lesson someday. But, you know, they always say all three results are possible. So the draw is considered a result only in test cricket. So fiction.
We'll agree to disagree on that one. Our next statement, within the next 5 years, USA cricket will start to make a name for themselves. Brother, is that fact or is that fiction?
I hope it's a fact. I mean, we've seen false, you know, alarms before from American cricket, false starts maybe in 2004. Like I said, they played in the qualified for the ICC Champions Trophy and yeah, we're okay. I mean, as newcomers, they did whatever they had to do. So that's fine. But they never progressed. I mean, they never continued from there. Like you've seen Afghanistan and Bangladesh and so many other countries grow as cricketing countries. Ireland, for example. I mean, Ireland hadn't played a ICC event in 2004. They made their first ever appearance in 2007 in the World Cup. The 50-over World Cup. And look where Irish cricket is now. They're a test team. So a lot of expectations were placed on the US to reach that level. They haven't, but the cricket has come along. Looks like the political maelstrom that was affecting them the last few years, the two associations we spoke about last week, seems to have settled down. Women's cricket, they're putting in good pathways. A lot of money has been pumped in by the Times of India group, by Craig Bars, who I work for, and a lot of Bollywood celebrities have put money into American cricket, Shah Rukh Khan one being one. So there has been a lot being done, a lot of attention being paid to American cricket. And I think, actually, I'm pretty confident that it is a fact. The statement is a fact, not even hoping anymore, because it's the world needs a... I mean, people will say no, but the cricket world needs the USA and China playing. I mean, yeah, they haven't played the sport for, the first ever cricket match, of course, was USA versus Canada. That's what shocks people. Not England versus Australia. That was the first test match. But the first competitive cricket match between two countries was the US versus Canada. I remember saying this on Carl and Lauren's show more than a year ago. I mean, that, like, you know, that was... So the whole Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels thing was based on that, you know, Canada versus America. But anyway, I'm just forcing this milk and cookie combination on that time around. But I think hopefully US cricket does turn the corner, and now I'm confident that it will.
Yeah, I also think it's a fact. I mean, we have an amazing fast bowler out there, Ali Khan, who is making a name for himself in many tournaments, not just here in America, but worldwide. We also have, like you were talking about, there are people investing in tournaments here, including Bollywood stars like Shah Rukh Khan. We're trying to start what they're calling Major League Cricket. And the way that they're starting that is next year, they're going to start Minor League Cricket first as kind of a test run, and then have those players maybe filter through to Major League Cricket, which is where Shah Rukh Khan will own a team in Los Angeles, and it's being rumored, shockingly, the Los Angeles Knight Riders. Surprise, surprise. but I, you know, I think, like you were saying, you know, there's a pathway now for women's cricket, and that was the biggest step for me as far as USA being taken seriously. I do think that part of what my statement is, why I think it's true, is I think USA cricket in 5 years will be taken seriously in the ICC and other countries. Whether that carries over to people in America, I don't know. I think maybe closer to 10 years for that, for it to be with, like, continuously going. But within 5 years, the ICC will definitely take USA cricket more seriously, as well as the other cricket boards that are part of the ICC. And I mean, we're starting to get more cricket grounds here in America that are being sanctioned by the ICC. I know it's taking a very long time for that, but it's coming. It's coming, like we were talking about.
Yeah.
Jimmy Smith saying in an interview, "I've been doing nothing but homework and lived pro wrestling since January shows that Adnan Virk was just there as a transition piece. Is that fact or fiction?" And I say it's a fact. Ooh. Look, I said last week, as well. Why didn't WWE give Adnan Virk the same tools that they had given Jimmy Smith? If Jimmy Smith, who just started in, I think it was the end of May, that was a week ago, so yeah, end of May, has been doing homework since January, that's 4 months of preparation work. Why did they sign Adnan Virk and then just throw him out there without any sort of homework or without working with Michael Cole like Jimmy Smith did? I think they put him out there because they didn't want the team that they had at the time, and they just wanted a placeholder until Jimmy Smith was ready. And I think that's why when Adnan Virk was let go, it was said that it was amicable. They both wanted him to go. And that shows me that, hey, we're putting him on this deal, and we told him up front, like, look, you're just here for now. Eventually, we're going to move on because we have somebody in the wings just waiting. So I think with Jimmy Smith just outright saying, you know, I have been entrenched in this wrestling world since January preparing for this, shows that Adnan Virk was just there to be a transition.
I didn't expect my... Sorry. I was just trying to do some live research, Rajiv, my fault. So I put myself on mute. No, but I have to disagree with you yet again, my friend, because I think that is fiction. The way I look at it is... I think they were looking at both of them. Adnan Virk takes over Raw, and eventually Jimmy Smith goes to SmackDown. Because if you read about Adnan Virk and how he got into WWE, it had a lot to do with his relationship with Nick Khan, who was his manager for a long time before he joined the WWE. And you could hear, I read quotes from Adnan Virk where he said, it's a relationship business. So there was a lot of trust in that whole, in the way it worked out. He had to audition. He auditioned in February. So you're right about the fact that Jimmy Smith was notified maybe about it before him. But the way I look at it is the WWE is trying to go mainstream. Just look at their product now. Everything we discussed earlier, everything Conrad says, everything Rajiv and Bharat say, and also that they want not just the product in the ring to go more mainstream, but also with whether it's zombies or, you know, lights going out and a woman shrieking at the end of a show, or when it comes to commentary. We saw Adnan Virk, and now we're seeing Jimmy Smith. I think the way they looked at it was, and this is my opinion, that Adnan worked for Raw, Jimmy Smith for SmackDown. Of course, it didn't work out. And look, I mean, going back to Adnan Virk, his current manager was Nick Khan's protege, is what we read. So, which means that there is a business relationship. I don't think they would have taken Adnan for a ride, the way you put it across. If I'm correct me if I'm wrong. And it's been interesting listening to Jimmy Smith. I watched a bit of Raw this time, a lot of it last week. And he does seem to have acclimatized. So he seems to have done his homework right. So it comes through during his commentary. And he was on Busted Open Radio, wasn't he? And he spoke about how the first week he heard Adnan Virk, and he thought that Adnan Virk wasn't heard enough. So he really upped his tone, his delivery, and apparently, Corey Graves and Brian Saxon asked him to come down a little, to come down to their level. So, as a call-by-call guy, I don't think call-by-call guy. I'm getting everything mixed up here, Rajiv. Ball-by-ball guy is what we call them in cricket. As the caller, nobody can... I guess everybody will be compared to Jim Ross, unfortunately, which means bringing a lot of natural, organic excitement, like Bill Laurie did with cricket, or Tony Gregg did, the late Tony Gregg. So it's good that Jimmy Smith is already getting introspective about how he's doing, how he's going about his commentary. But to think that, you know, Adnan Virk was, like you said, just, you know, brought in as an interim measure, I don't agree with it. Fiction, Rajiv, fiction.
See, but so part of your statement, I feel like, helps my argument, because he had that previous, he has that previous relationship with Nick Khan. I'm not saying that he was brought in with the thought of, I'm going to be here long term. I think they made the deal so that way it looked like he was supposed to be. But on the back end, him and Nick Khan were like, look, this isn't going to work long term because you don't know the product well enough. That's why Adnan was probably not hyping himself up, because he didn't want to get too invested in the job that he wasn't even going to keep. I think because of that, it was, hey, we're buddies. Can you help me out? We're in a transition period. We're going to make it look like you're here long term. But once Jimmy's ready, let's move. We'll part ways amicably.
Yeah, well, you do make an interesting case, and I do hate myself for having given you that little opening that you exploited. But anyway,
you gave me some ammo, and I loved it. And now we're going to move on to terms and conditions with our resident expert, Bharat Sundaresan. Bharat, something interesting. England got fined 40% of their match fee for maintaining a slow over rate in the first test against New Zealand. And that brought up a question that I didn't have a real answer to from one of my American friends that had read about it. And I think it's going to be beneficial for everybody that's listening to this, not just my friend that had a really good question. So what is a slow over rate, and how exactly is that measured?
Right. An over rate is basically, just to explain the term itself, is you're expected to bowl X number of overs per hour so that you complete 90 overs in 6 hours. So test cricket is divided into, each day's play is divided into three sessions of 2 hours each, and you're expected to bowl 30 overs in each session. So, which means every over on an average should last for 4 minutes. So you try to finish an over within 4 minutes. Of course, it does take a little longer when you have a fast bowler with a long run up. He runs in, so he has to run in and bowl and then walk all the way back. Of course, it depends on what happens in the over. There might be a few boundaries scored. There might be a wicket that falls. So then a batsman has to leave and the batsman has to replace him, or a batter batsman, however you want to describe it. Or it could be a spinner like Ravindra Jadeja who bowls a maiden, where, you know, he bowls off two steps. He's very quick and he can finish an over within a minute at times. Like, you know, he's that quick, or a minute and a half. But the over rate was in place so that play just doesn't dawdle along, you know. And if you look back in the history of Test cricket, they used to bowl a lot more overs. There used to be 98 overs bowled once upon a time. There used to be 104 overs bowled in a day in the 60s and 70s. But of course, with ads and broadcasting changing everything in sport, and with TV replays coming into the picture in the early 90s, everything changed, and they said, okay, right, we'll calculate all that and put everything into perspective and we'll make it 90 overs a day. And initially, teams were okay with it. They would push it on and off, but rarely did you hear about people going over time, over rates over time in the 90s. But it just started to get worse in the early 2000s and as the 21st century has moved on. So a slow over rate basically is if you can't bowl your overs in time. So in fact, to make up for any kind of stoppage in play, you know, whether it's someone getting injured or if it's a hot day, drinks coming into onto the ground more often than they need to, the ICC even allows an extra half hour every day, you know, for some unforeseen circumstance. That's how it started off. In case there is something that doesn't happen in an ordinary day's play, you have that extra half hour to finish your 90 overs. But then the last few years, it's just become a norm where it's not a 6 hour day. I mean, 7 hour day of test cricket, including the two session breaks, lunch break of 40 minutes and a tea break for 20 minutes. But it's just counted as 7.5 hours. So you have 6.5 hours to bowl 90 overs. But still teams have struggled to, you know, finish their overs in time. And the current England-New Zealand test match at Lord's was shambolic in terms of over rate. So not only did you lose a whole day's play due to rain, which is an unforeseen circumstance or, you know, nature at play. The first 3 days of play, so for the first 4 days, you lost 21 overs. That's a lot of cricket. And a broadcaster, a fan at the ground, the fan watching it on TV, they pay for 90 overs of cricket, right? So when you don't give them, somebody has to be held accountable. For a long time, it was the captain. So the captain would get fined. The captain would get mismatches. We spoke about demerit points last week. So there used to be demerit points in place for over rate. So because the captain was held responsible, he's the general on the field. But then 2 years ago, they took that off and they started fining teams. And Australia would have been playing India in the World Test Championship final if they had bowled their overs on time during that Sydney Test. So because they were so bad that they were 4 points was deducted from their World Test Championship tally, and they're not playing the final in England. Well, the Australian players are spread around Australia currently. So that's pretty much the history of over rate, why it's in place. And the reason why people don't respect it in my book is because, you know, you're talking about some extremely opulent cricketers and cricket teams. So 20%, 40% of the match fee, does it really hurt them? I don't think so. You're now even taken away the whole thing of captains being banned or suspended. So the captain really is not personally affected if the overs aren't completed in time, unlike in this extreme case with Australia missing out on a World Test Championship final. A lot of people have come up with solutions. Give run penalties because that hurts, right? Like, you know, if 10 runs or 20 runs are taken away, maybe give a wicket penalty. I don't know why nobody talks about it. Like, say, no, only you only have 8 wickets to play with, not 10 wickets in innings. Or something like that needs to come into place because it's becoming a joke now. And I mean, over rates, we're talking about test cricket, but there are over rates in one day and T20 cricket as well. But even there, you see the IPL is a major culprit there. Games just go on endlessly. I've been a victim of it covering the IPL back home in India. You wouldn't get home by 1:32. Games would just go on. They're supposed to finish at 11:15, but they wouldn't get finished before 12:15, 12:30 at times. So it's an issue that is facing cricket, but yeah, nobody seems to know why. You heard the commentators during the England-New Zealand test match. The umpires seem to have lost control. Drinks are just being brought out. And it's an issue that I face in junior cricket as an umpire, Rajiv. The kids just don't get a move on at times. But at least with under 14, under 16 kids, you can give them a nudge and say, mate, you have to, like, you know, you have to finish, or like, you know, you lose this or that. But it's an endemic issue right from through the grassroots to the senior level. But look, if the test cricketers aren't paying any heed to it, why do you expect a 14 or a 13-year-old in Adelaide to do though?
Yeah, they're going to follow what they're seeing because that's the level they want to get to. So, of course, they're going to try to do the same things that they're seeing on TV. And, you know, this is something that wrestlers or people in the wrestling business say all the time. So it might be good for our listeners who don't know wrestling very well to understand this word as well. And I just need to know, but what is kayfabe?
Well, kayfabe pretty much is the difference between The Undertaker and Mark Calloway. I mean, I can sum it up in just that one line. Kayfabe basically is a term which has been used in wrestling for, I think, 70 or 80 years, even when it used to be part of the traveling circus, as we've heard a lot of former wrestlers refer it to in the 30s and the 20s, which it basically means to protect your gimmick. To protect the reality of the pro wrestling world and make sure that nobody outside it finds out that that's not real, if that makes any sense. So, like I said, The Undertaker and Mark Calloway. Mark Calloway is a human being just like you and me, but The Undertaker is a character. So, for the longest time, when people did not know what is pro wrestling, is it real, is it false, do these people really hate each other, do these people like each other, they were expected to protect that secret. Kayfabe stands for, I don't know what it exactly stands for, but it's basically the secret of pro wrestling, or the secrets wherein, like, do people really hurt each other? Is it real? Is it a real sport? Is it just theater? I mean, I call it the greatest form of theater because it's got everything in it. It's got, and the beauty of it is if Rajiv and Bharat get into a ring, in an actual wrestling ring, in many ways, we are trying to hurt each other. But in a pro wrestling ring, we are doing everything we can to not hurt each other while trying to convince everyone who's watching us that we are hurting each other. It's whoever came up with this concept is a genius. How many ever years ago? It's just fascinating. It plays games with the human mind, I believe. So, but yeah, for the longest time, protecting kayfabe was almost an unwritten rule in wrestling. For example, the good guys could never travel with the bad guys in a car. Some people never, like in Mexico, people did not take their masks off. Even when they went to the supermarkets, they still do that. Like, you know, Lucha Libre is a big deal in Mexico. So if you're a mask wrestler, you're a mask wrestler, you're a mask man everywhere you go. And similarly, I mean, in the U.S., like I said, the good guys could never travel with the bad guys. We always hear about the story where Hacksaw Jim Duggan and the Iron Sheik. The one was a good guy, one was a bad guy. They get stopped for carrying drugs in the car. But the biggest issue in the wrestling world was not them getting arrested with drugs. It was how can a good guy and a bad guy be traveling and be seen traveling together? And The Undertaker is the master. I think he held on to kayfabe in the 21st century when social media and the internet became a major deal. I think kayfabe started dying. Of course, people will point to Vince McMahon coming out openly and saying this is not real. But I still think kayfabe was kept alive for much longer after that statement. I mean, look, that was said many years before the famous or infamous Montreal Screwjob. People still debate whether it's real or not, whether it was kayfabe or like, yeah, another term we get to hear a lot in wrestling, shoot and work. Like a shoot is something which is real. If I actually punch Rajiv and he's hurt and I want to hurt him on purpose, that's a shoot. If I keep punching him and while Rajiv feels like, you know, he's been hit by a pillow, not a fist, but the world thinks that, wow, that must really hurt Rajiv, then that's a work. They all form into this overall term called kayfabe. I've used kayfabe in cricketing copies. I'll send you a couple of them. I've used it quite a few times. You know, I think there is, if you look at it, there is kayfabe to everything we do in life. I think every field, every profession in the world has its trade secrets, which you will never divulge. I mean, there are definitely trade secrets in journalism. There are definitely trade secrets in what you do, Rajiv. And I'm sure there are a lot of trade secrets in theater. I'm sure, correct me if I'm wrong. So I think kayfabe exists everywhere. It's just that it needed to be controlled or maintained for a longer time and was more extreme in something like pro wrestling.
There's even a little kayfabe with our podcast, Chop On, but we won't get into that. Now, it's time to go over the ropes. This is where we go over the ropes of the present back into the past. But at you and I, we're both Indian. It's discussed just about every year, especially in June. Throughout June of 1983, the third edition of the Cricket World Cup had taken place in England and Wales. What can you tell us about this monumental tournament?
It changed India as a country in my book. It just did not change, take Indian cricket to the next level. I think it taught India to believe, because you're talking about 1983. India as a country, new India, was how old? It was 36 years old. Think about it. We got our independence in 1947 when the British left. So it was a 36-year-old country still trying to fight for its identity in many ways, right? I mean, a lot of people around at that time were born in during the British Raj, during the British rule. So they were trying to break out and embrace their own identities. Whereas, you know, these cricketers, most of them who were born just after independence, who played in the 1983 World Cup, were born in independent India. So, but they were still trying to, you know, get over this term, which still gets bandied around in India, the colonial hangover. And sport was one field where you could do it. And there's a reason why hockey is still India's national sport for all this love that cricket gets. Cricket is not India's national sport. It's hockey, because India was that bloody good in hockey, field hockey. Before they turned to AstroTurf, there is this whole conspiracy that they turned to AstroTurf to because the Indians could not keep up with the speed, because the Indians were so good on, like, you know, on mud or dirt surfaces, because they were so much more skillful. And India won Olympic medal. I mean, they were great at Olympics. They won World Cups. They were very good in hockey till the early 80s. But Indian cricket, well, it, you know, they played their first test match when the British were still ruling them. So there was a little bit of incest there in some ways. But, you know, that happened at the Bombay Gymkhana in Bombay in the 1930s. So they played quite a bit of test cricket even before they got independence. But, you know, from the time they became independent, or we became independent in 1947, Indian cricket wasn't still viewed as a superpower till 1971, when they went, Gavaskar came into the picture. They won, when went and won two back-to-back test series in West Indies and England. And that was the first step towards, I guess, becoming a superpower. But once one-day cricket came into being, it was similar to, like, you know, hockey going to AstroTurf. You needed faster scoring. You needed more powerful batsmen, I guess. You needed the game to be quicker. And the Indian team took a while to get come to grips with the one-day 50-over format. 1975 World Cup, the first ever World Cup. 1979 World Cup, they were just okay. I mean, they hardly even, like, you know, made an impression in those World Cups. Then you come to 1983. This is back when all World Cups were played in England. So this is the third consecutive World Cup in England. Not many gave them too much of a chance going in. It was a good, strong team. By then, Gavaskar was an established name. Kapil Dev, the great Kapil Dev, was a good 6 years into his career, was captain in that World Cup. You had youngsters like Ravi Shastri, Krishnamachari Srikanth. You had some, you know, old hands like a Mohinder Amarnath or a Madan Lal. Roger Binney was at its peak of his power. So it was a good one-day team. It had, it. If you look at that team, and everyone had a role, they had decent all-rounders, bowlers who could do well in England, like the Madan Lals and the Roger Binneys and the Balwinder Singh Sandhus of the world. But nobody really gave them a chance. And, you know, they go through the tournament. And then the first big obstacle was England in the semi-final. And at that point, and by then you have to realize, you have to know that West Indies won both in 1975 and 1979. I mean, they dominated the tournament. They had a little bit of trouble in 75. But 79, they just like ran roughshod over everyone. Crushed England in the final, and they were on their merry way to the final. And you know, and nobody even thought about what will happen in that other semi-final. So they just cruised into the final. So India England, people thought it's going to be another repeat of the 79 final. Like, you know, this English Indian team has done enough that they've reached their peak. They've peaked already. But beating England, it was a good game. Some interesting deliveries. You should see the ball that bowled Ian Botham out. It went like, you know. I think it's Kirti Azad who bowls the ball. It really almost went along the ground. But anyway, it was a strong England team. So even after India won that semi-final, nobody gave them a chance to, you know, topple the mighty West Indies. Like, you know, this was West Indies at their peak. They were the indomitable West Indians. So nobody gave... It was the classic David versus Goliath in the final. And also a few other important things were happening in India. 1982, we had the Asian Games. So the television set became a more common entity in India. More households got television sets during the Asian Games than any other time in history. Kind of context for all American listeners. I heard Eric Bischoff talk about this on one of his shows a few months ago, about how in the 1950s, having a TV was a major deal. And I was like, wow, really? Having a TV was a major deal in India in the 1980s. Like, you know, even after I was born in 1985. So... TV was coming, come onto the scene. Like, in a lot of houses had television sets, and you know, you hear so many stories from the likes of Tendulkar and so many others from that era, who really believed that even they could become major cricketers after seeing that final. Lakshman, Dravid, Ganguly, Tendulkar were all 10 or 11 at that stage, and you know, India get bowled out cheaply. In their innings, they bat first. Of course, they made the famous total of 183, and nobody really gave India a chance. And it was just a matter of time. People felt the West Indies is going to smash these runs in before you know it. And yeah, I mean, they'll be three-time world champions. And then Balwinder Singh Sandhu bowls the ball that, you know, to this day, if you ask him, he's a wonderful guy, jolly guy, and lives in Bombay. He's from Bombay. He didn't expect the ball to come in as much as it did. But you see Gordon Greenidge shouldering arms, leaving the ball alone. And that really set the tone for an extraordinary evening at Lord's, at the home of cricket, where this... unlikely team just toppled the Giants. And Viv Richards famously came out smashing everyone around, got out to a quick start. And then he gets out to a remarkable catch from Kapil Dev. And just listening to the commentary from back then, Richie Benaud and Jim Laker were at their peak. Especially, I have to do this. Like, you know, when Viv Richards gets out, you hear Richie Beno say, good shot. And then there's a pause, classic Richie Beno style, because he hooks it and it hits the top edge of the bat and it goes up. And Kapil Dev has to run back quite a few yards. And so you hear Richie Beno say, good shot. And then, well, not so good. And Kapil Dev has taken a remarkable catch. And then, you know, once Viv Richards is out, people still believe there's still Lloyd, there's still Dujon. Somebody will come and make. It's not a big total even for them. It 183 wasn't a big total. Wickets kept falling. And before you knew it, you could hear Jim Laker go, that's it, it's all over this time. Michael Olden losing his cool in the end. India, the run of the ground is Prudential Cup champions. And that's the thing. It was sponsored by Prudential, the I think it's an insurance company in the UK. So it wasn't still called the World Cup. Like, you know, it was the World Cup, but they still called it the Prudential Cup. So it was just a glorious moment. You know, Dilip Vensarkar wasn't playing that game in the, at the Lord's Bank balcony cheering, and then, you know, them going off, Kapil Dev lifting the trophy, Chris Srikanth smoking a cigarette in the background. It just was that moment which turned everything around. You know, India would go on to become the superpower in world cricket, not just on the field, off the field, maybe 20 years later. But the foundation was set in 1983. And like I said, it gave India, the country, that confidence that, you know, we can also stand up with the best of the best and with these first world countries as a young nation. And, you know, it in many ways was our second Independence Day.
It was the stuff that dreams are made of, and that was amazing. I loved hearing you say everything that you said about that World Cup. Thank you for that, brother. And thank you all so much for tuning in to this fantastic episode of Chop On. We really appreciate all the love and support that we have been receiving lately. You know, Budith, I heard from somebody recently that said, you know, I don't really know cricket very well, but I love your guys' show and it's really opening my eyes. So I wanted to pass that on to you. And if you want to be enlightened by either cricket or wrestling as well, we do it every week, every Wednesday in the US at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Thursdays in India at 6 a.m. IST and 10 a.m. ACST in Australia. But do you have any last words for our listeners before we head out of here this week?
Oh, no, just lots of love to our listeners. The only message I have is for your wonderful partner, Alex, can you please pass this on to her? I know I said this in the past, but you can see how hurt I am by her conduct against me on the wonderful podcast that is Talk and Dreams. But yeah, it's still strike two. It's still strike two.
I will let her know. Maybe this is her way of giving you a demerit point. I don't know. We'll see. So you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ChopOnPod. On Twitter, he is at BeastieBoy07. I am at TheRajiv8. Keep chopping on, people.